Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For nearly 400 years, the Comanche tribe controlled the southern plains of America. Even as Europeans arrived on the scene with guns and metal armor, the Comanches held them off with nothing but horses, arrows, lances, and buffalo hide shields. In the 18th century, the Comanches stopped the Spanish from driving north from Mexico and halted French expansion westward from Louisiana. In the 19th century, they stymied the development of the new country by engaging in a 40-year war with the Texas Rangers and the U.S. military. It wasn't until the latter part of that century that the Comanches finally laid down their arms. How did they create a resistance so fierce and long-lasting? Well, my guest today explores that question in his book, Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the most powerful Indian tribe in American history. His name is Sam Gwynn, and we begin our discussion by explaining where the Comanches were from originally and how their introduction to the horse radically changed their culture and kickstarted the precipitous rise to power. Sam then explains how the Comanches shifted from a hunting culture to a warrior culture and how their warrior culture was very similar to that of the ancient Spartans. We then discuss the event that began the decline of the Comanches, the kidnapping of a Texan girl named Cynthia Ann Parker. Sam explains how she went on to become the mother of the last great war chief of the Comanches, Quanah, why Quanah ultimately decided to surrender to the military, and the interesting path his life took afterward. This is a fascinating story about an oft-overlooked part of American history. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/Comanches. Sam joins me now via Skype. Sam Gwynn, welcome to the show.
It's good to be talking to you.
So you're the author of the book, Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the most powerful Indian tribe in American history. I grew up in Oklahoma. I live in Oklahoma. And, you know, you have to do Oklahoma history, but they always talk about just the five civilized tribes, which is an interesting history. The Comanches get like a passing, and the story is just phenomenal.
It's true in Texas, too. There's a lot of, I mean, they just blow by this. They certainly did. My daughter was in high school, you know, 10 years ago here. They just blew right by it. They never stopped.
Well, why is that? Why does the history of the Comanches get overlooked or blown by in history classes?
I don't know. It's a really good question. The plains are the high plains. The Comanche plains are the last part of America to be settled, of course. You know, the East settles and the West settles, and then you've got this thing sitting out here that is really the plains extending down from the northern plains that were controlled by the Sioux through the central Cheyennes and Arapahoes and then Comanches. And you had this very uncivilized, shall we say, middle that took a very long time to settle. And on some level, I think that it may be because they're just... because of that fact, there just wasn't anything out here, really. I mean, this was a frontier, and because it was a frontier, it wasn't crawling with reporters necessarily, and it just never had the play. And it was even something like the Red River War, which is an extremely significant sort of moment in American history. It was kind of, you know, the end of the frontier, and the frontier ended here in Texas. It didn't end in California. It ended here. These things didn't get covered very well. They didn't get written about that well. And I don't know. I mean, it's been a privilege and an honor for me to be able to restore it in some way, certainly here in Texas, because it wasn't that the Comanche period here in Texas was not really part of the conversation.
And so what led you down that path? Did you come across a story, or was it your, you know, your daughter, you know, going through Texas history in high school and like Comanches sort of got a quick pass? I mean, did you come across something that said, there's a bigger story here that I need to write about and research?
Yeah. So it is all related to me, the Connecticut Yankee, moving to Texas and having absolutely no clue about the history here and kind of going around, walking around and saying, oh, wow, look at that. Gee, I never knew that. Really? This is, you know, the idiot Easterner who doesn't know any better. I mean, you know, that's who I was. And I thought, this is just incredibly cool. And I went out on the high plains and then I heard about the, you know, these nomadic tribes that lived out there and this whole kind of world that I had never known about. I've never even heard about. And so living here, so what made me write it was moving to Texas, which I did 26 years ago, and I'm still here. I came here, I was just kind of on the circuit as a, you know, I was a bureau chief for Time Magazine. I'd been in LA, Los Angeles for Time Magazine and Detroit and Washington and New York. And this was another stop on the way, you know? And I mean, it was like, okay, but I got here and I just started hearing, first of all, you start hearing things because Texas is really close to its frontier. And I mean, when I grew up in the East Coast, whatever Native Americans had been around when the white man arrived had been pretty much killed off, at least in large numbers, by disease mostly, but also by weapons and bullets and things like that. And the subjugation of the Indians had happened hundreds of years before my forebears ever got off the boat. In Texas, that wasn't true. The history was, it was right here. It was just in your face. You're from Oklahoma. You know this.
Right.
This is immediate. It's you, you know, the last of the Indians did not surrender here until 1875. And there was a lot of jostling on and off the res that went on into the 20th century. And I would just hear these stories. And these were, you know, stories that seemed like they were kind of almost current day. It was a very different take on it. But yeah, it was all where I was. And this incredible sense of the land in particular, a love affair that I've had with the land west of, or in West Texas. And just this incredible history that happened down here.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Comanches because, like I said, I didn't know much about this tribe. I think when we talk about Native Americans, particularly here in Oklahoma, like I said, you talk about the Cherokees, the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, or you talk, if you're in the East Coast, you're talking about the Iroquois. The Comanches don't get much, they don't get talked about, but like they're a fascinating, fascinating culture. They were primarily in Texas, West Texas, Southwest Oklahoma, and went into New Mexico, but they weren't originally from there, which I didn't know. Where were they from originally?
So the origin of the tribe is, you sort of put this together as best you can, or rather the people who were there at the time put this together as best as you can. As far as we know, they were originally a Shoshone language group tribe, and they were in the Wind River Mountains, or basically the foothills of the Wind River Mountains in Wyoming. And this would be now going back prior to the 18th century. And from what we know, they were back then, this was before the Spanish horses arrived and were distributed throughout the plains. They didn't have horses. They were a foot-bound band of nomadic hunter-gatherers. And they were, as far as we know, a tribe that was not militarily powerful. And one of the reasons that is surmised is because their hunting grounds were not the rich hunting grounds of the buffalo or bison plains, but they were less good hunting grounds. And so you had this amazing thing that happened in history, and it happened away from the eyes of white men. And again, you ask, like, why do people know these things? Well, this thing you can see in flashes, or rather the Spanish and the French could see it in flashes. But suddenly, you know, what happens is that the Spanish arrive in the New World right after 1492, after Columbus, and the Spanish arrive in the New World, and they bring horses with them. And with them comes this incredible technology of horses that's thousands of years old, that's very specific, and the Spanish are really good at it. And they bring these little horses, Mustangs, that are really well adapted to the arid areas in the West. And they were very concerned initially about letting the technology out, right? They didn't want to let it out, because they knew what might happen. Well, it got out. And without going into all of the details, basically the Native Americans on the plains, in the American plains, North American plains, got hold of the horse. And the tribe that was by far the best at this were the Comanches. They were, for some reason, nobody still understands what there was about them that understood it, the horse, in terms of breaking, breeding, you know, whatever it was, stealing, selling, racing, hunting with, fighting, whatever. They were better than anybody else at it. And endowed with this new power, this phenomenal technology of the horse and mastery of it, starting in the 17th century, aided by such things as the Great Horse Dispersal, which is when the Indians were, Spanish were driven out of New Mexico briefly and 20,000 horses got out. Anyway, the horse, Comanche with horses now, now they start to move south from those Wind River Mountains, which is where I said they were in Wyoming, right? They're going to move south. They're going to challenge everybody and anything in front of them. And what they're going to challenge for is the greatest food source on the plains, which is the buffalo, who are essentially in the southern plains. I mean, there were buffalo in the northern plains, but nowhere near the numbers. So the new power, the new great plains power, is going to do what you think they would do. And then they move south and they migrate. And that is when essentially they enter this, they kind of enter history as they start to migrate south.
And this is, so they became even more adept hunters because they were able to migrate more quickly with the buffalo. It allowed, it gave them an advantage in hunting buffalo as well because they could chase them down from their horses. But as you note in the book, something else happened as they started colliding with other tribes in the area, particularly the Apache. Their culture started changing from a hunter culture to a warrior culture. How did that manifest itself? What do we know about that?
Yes, that's a really good point. The Comanche, the incredibly warlike, you'd have to look to something like Sparta, you know, a culture that was built on war, where social status came from war, where everything was kind of oriented that way. It came from a fairly long war against the Apaches that amounted in the end almost to a genocide. The Comanches were sweeping south from Wyoming, what is now Wyoming, into the southern plains, which, as you said, was, think of eastern Colorado, eastern New Mexico, western Kansas, western Oklahoma, western Texas, the southern plains. This is where the Comanches are moving toward. There's ground occupied by Apaches. And you have this long war that's very bitter and mostly unrecorded and very, very brutal that the Apaches lose. And eventually, you know, by the time you see, you know, Geronimo running around the borderlands of Mexico, that's kind of where the Apaches eventually ended up, down along a strip along the borderlands. But what's interesting about this, getting back to your original question, is, you know, and the Spanish, before I get to that, the Spanish, by the way, see this in flashes. And the Apaches are the Spanish have this kind of capital up in Santa Fe, what is now New Mexico. And they see this strange thing happening. Their enemies, their great implacable enemies, the Apaches, are going away. Something's going on. They don't quite know what it is. Something's happening to their enemies. At some point, they realize what's happening to their enemies. They're losing a war to the Comanches. But what's happening to the Comanches, so the Apaches are being driven south, but what's happening to the Comanches is, because of this long war, it reorders their culture. As you say, it's not just it is now a culture of war. It is now a culture, particularly because they're so good at it. They work at it. They get better at it. They can subjugate other tribes, which they do. They can drive tribes off their hunting grounds, which they do. They can nearly commit genocide on the Apaches, which they do. And so you have this kind of amazing cultural shift inside the Comanche nation. And so by the time, you know, the first kind of Anglo-Europeans heading west see them in Texas in 1832 or 1834, it's this unbelievably unified kind of militaristic tribe that controls a 250,000 square mile empire with 20 vassal tribes. And I mean, it's not an empire like Rome, but it's a plains empire, and it's built on their martial ability. So it completely changed them, and it turned them from, I guess, if you look at them originally, kind of a bunch of nomadic Stone Age, you know, hunter-gatherers, into this kind of magnificent mounted war machine.
And how did, so you mentioned Sparta, you know, and Sparta is known for its agoge, like how they raised their boys to become warriors. The Comanches had something similar. Like they had sort of a training for the, that starts very young, like as young as three, for their boys to become these great cavalrymen, these great warriors of the plains.
They were indeed that is true, and they were very. As the culture evolved, the boys had to do really two things, and really only two things, and the women had to do everything else. And the two things were hunt and fight. And yes, as the culture changed, and as their abilities with the bow and arrow, the abilities with the horse became more sophisticated, these rituals of passage, as you were a kid, you know, when you were first turned out to hunt, you know, small game, and then later larger game, but particularly taught to ride. And the thing that the power, I mean, the Comanche power came from certainly their ability to fight, you know, with your hands and with the plains lances and with bows and things like that. But it also came, and it primarily came from the horse. And so what was trained as much as anything, or more than anything, was horsemanship. They were just phenomenal horsemen, and to the point where the tales told about them are scarcely believable even today. I mean, you know what they could do on a horse. It was part of that big cultural change.
Yeah, there are things like, you know, they would hide, like they'd shoot a bow and arrow from underneath the neck of the horse, right, while it's still galloping.
White men couldn't believe that one.
Yeah.
And the other thing they could do is they could discharge arrows at a rate, you know, that it just defies imagination. I mean, it is literally, I'm snapping my fingers now, like that. And if you don't believe me, go to this website where this guy, Lars Anderson, he'll show you. There's no quiver involved. It's a way of holding the arrows. Anyway, all the things that they could do, from particularly shooting, but also just riding, you know, that trick that you're talking about where you loop down a leather loop over the saddle, over the very minimal Spanish saddle. And they would hang over the neck of the horse, which would, of course, conceal them from their enemies and also enable them to discharge arrows, but with such force that they, you know, they'd go through the head of a buffalo. So very, very deadly. And as I say, when the white men first saw them, they couldn't quite believe what they were seeing. And the skills with horses applied to, you know, everything, breaking horses. I mean, they watched them break these horses, and they'd never seen anything. The white men had never seen anything like it before. You know, the Comanches would trail a horse or a couple of horses, and they would just trail the horse. And every time the horse got near, and you couldn't catch the horse, of course, because the horse was wild. But every time the horse got near water, they would kind of bother the horse. It's the same way a wolf brings down a moose. And so this would go on for a couple of days. And eventually the horse was just completely, you know, foaming at the mouth and dying of thirst. And there were various techniques and ways this happened, but at one point the Comanche warrior would go and literally put his hands over the nozzle, muzzle of the horse, and blow into its nostrils. And suddenly the horse goes from this wild thing to being immediately gentled. And anyway, there were all these stories that people had told about the Comanches that white men had never seen before anyway. You've got to be careful saying no one.
Right.
White men had never seen them before.
Well, speaking of something that flummoxed Europeans when they first encountered the Comanches, and going on this idea of the warrior culture of the Comanches, they had a specific type of warfare, a style of warfare, that when the Europeans first encountered the Spanish, they couldn't stop it. They'd never seen it before, and it threw them for a loop.
For one thing, I mean, the white men always insisted on this kind of Napoleonic confrontation, you know, where you would march out and there you were in your ranks, you know, you would take your regiment and it would be standing in its ranks two or three deep in the regiment, and then they would line up and ready, aim, fire, right? This was not the Comanches would never take that fight. They would never get near anything like that. They would never fight you like that. They would not. Obey all of the rules of white men's war, which in those days was essentially lining up two regiments against each other and firing at each other from a distance of about 100 yards away. And they wouldn't play that way. They were all about stealth. They moved making cold camps, so there was no fire. They swam their horses through frozen rivers that you wouldn't think you could cross. I mean, they attacked by night. They gave no quarter, which is another thing that white men weren't really used to. But especially, I think that, you know, this idea of completely mobile warfare, Comanches were mobile. They didn't, a dragoon is a thing what characterized a lot of the troops in Spain, is something that a dragoon is a type of soldier who usually pretty heavily mounted, heavily armed and heavily mounted. He rides the horse to the place of the fight, gets off the horse and fights. It's like driving a car to the battle, except it's a horse. Comanches were entirely mounted and fought mounted and did everything mounted. And it was the thing that distinguished them really from everybody else. It was the complete oneness with the horse. And it was, I think, as much as anything, again, I keep coming back to the horse, but as much as anything, it was the unity of warrior and horse that made the difference.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM, masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
Yeah, going back to that idea you said about how the Comanches were very similar to the Spartans. One thing, and I, as I was reading this book, your book, I was like, that's exactly right. So, you know, training to be a warrior since a little boy, same thing in the Spartans. The Spartans also loved to gamble. The Comanches men also loved to gamble. Right, loved to gamble. The Spartan men didn't do anything except for train for war, hunt. They didn't do anything else than that. Same thing with Comanche.
Same deal.
Yeah. So I thought as I was reading that, I thought that was really interesting.
It's very similar. And in both places, your social status was entirely based on war. Okay. That's where how many horses you had, how many wives, whatever it was, but those things came from performance in war.
Yeah. For the Spartans, it would have been like the trophies you brought home, shields, armor that you brought home from your conquered. Well, another part of Comanche warfare I'll tell you how I found your book. So I'm a big Lonesome Dove fan. Uh-huh. And I've read the original novel like four times, named my kid Gus after Gus McRae. And then this year I finally decided I'm going to read the other novels in the series because, you know, McMurtry wrote Dead Man's Walk,
Comanche Moon,
which are prequels. And I was reading Comanche Moon and Dead Man's Walk, and they're describing the torture that the Comanches did. And I was like, he's got to be doing some like artistic license. It didn't happen like this. And then I started researching, and I found your book, and then I learned, yeah, the Comanches were like experts at torture. What was going on there?
Yeah, so one of the things you have to come to terms with if you're a historian writing about Native Americans, and this isn't just confined to the Plains, is the practice of mistreating or torturing captives. And it is all over America, North America. I don't know much about the tribes south of the Rio Grande, say, but I do know about the ones north, and it was part of the culture. And certainly in the Plains Indians, it was, and it was pretty simple. So let's just go back for a moment to the time before the white men came. So you would have Indian tribes that pretty much fought each other all the time. There was a culture of raiding, and the raid always produced a counter raid, and then a counter counter raid, and then there were vengeance raids, and this kind of went on, and the code was pretty similar, and the Comanches certainly had it, but so did the, we'll just look at the Plains Indians for the moment. The rest of the Plains Indians did too. And what that said was, if you captured a baby, you just killed the baby. The baby's useless and an annoyance, and you can't take it on the road, so to speak. Young children might be killed or they might be spared. The Comanches in particular had trouble kind of keeping their numbers up. So they took captives, and they were very welcoming, all kinds of captives, from Utes and Apaches and Navajos and people from Mexico and German Americans. I mean, they would take whoever they could get. And usually those people were in the children captives that they allowed to live would be in the, 8 or 9, 10, 11, maybe that range. There's a lot of famous ones, and I write about them. Then you have, let's say, a teenage girl or a 17-year-old girl would be made a slave, probably a sex slave, as well as a slave of labor, hard labor forever. And then you had the warriors in the tribe. They would be killed. They would be, if they were captured alive, they would be tortured either slowly or quickly, and that all depended on how much time the winning tribe had or the tribe that had them had. And so you had this idea of just absolutely crazy mistreatment by the standards of that kind of enlightened culture of the Renaissance and, the Judeo-Christian tradition and all this, this culture that has these ideas of absolute good and evil, which the Indians don't have. So suddenly this culture, in Texas anyway, from this Anglo-European culture arrives on the frontier and looks at babies being killed and pregnant women being eviscerated and, people being tortured to death by their eyelids cut off and the penis tortures and the ant tortures and the sun tortures and all the tortures that McMurtry writes about and that I write about. And they're just absolutely horrified. I mean, these white people are horrified, as you are, as I am. But it took the white people to be horrified. See if I can explain that. So the there was, if you will, a golden rule, like it's a backwards kind of golden rule, but it was still a golden rule. It was, you would expect your, you'd try to treat your enemies the way that you might expect to be treated. And all of the Native Americans out there, if you took Navajos and Comanches, for example, the warriors had exactly the same expectations of what was going to happen. The women with children had exactly the same expectations. In other words, if their baby was taken, the baby would be killed. If their tribe took a baby from another tribe, they would kill the baby. There was a stasis of expectation, I guess. It was an interesting moment in history because you have a culture of raid and counter-raid, and we're talking about just Indians now before the white man gets there. And all this stuff that just curdles the white man's stomach going on, except that it didn't bother the Indians. Not only that, but you have the culture of raid and counter-raid and torture, but also you had this kind of pretty much infinitely renewable and sustainable food source, the buffalo. So there was this kind, if you look at, say, late 18th century, early 19th century on the plains, this is a totally sustainable society. They understand the ground rules that each other lives by. They got plenty of food and everything's fine. Now, you wouldn't think it was so fine if you got caught and had your eyelids. Yeah, I mean, whatever. I won't go on. But that's what it was. White men arrived. Oh, the horror, the shock. And lo and behold, the white people learned from them too. And they, you know, when the Texas Rangers were said to give no quarter, that was true. They didn't give quarter. And not giving quarter, when you think about it, is if someone's attacking a village with men, women, and children in it, it's not a very pretty thing. So it happened to both sides. But it is an interesting thing as a historian. I think as anyone who reads about it too, you have to come to terms with this. This is what they did. And it's a fact. And they did it all over North America. And not only that, but the white people learned pretty quickly about scalping and torture themselves and often employed it just as liberally as the Native Americans did. It's a very kind of touchy and difficult thing to come to terms with.
It is, because I think in America, I think you note this in the book, in America at least, we have that very Rousseau idea of the noble savage, you know, peaceful, et cetera. But, you know, as you said, it is what it is. That's how it happened. We'll talk about how Anglos changed their manner of war here in a bit with the Texas Rangers. But to note, because of the style of warfare the Comanches had, they were able, and also another thing that's interesting about the Comanches, unlike a lot of other tribes, say like back east or the Cherokees or the Choctaws, their political organization, really wasn't a single chief for the entire Comanche tribe. It was more fluid and more flat.
It was, and white men never understood that. Comanches were organized, a lot of plains tribes were, but Comanches were organized in bands. And it was entirely, if you looked at it as a management chart, it's completely horizontal management chart. And you would have, within the bands, you would have a civil chief and a war chief technically, but even then, so not only was there not one big head guy, and the white men always thought they were making the treaty with the big head guy, never was any big head guy. They totally got that wrong. But not only was there not a big head guy, but even within the bands, Comanches had five major bands early 19th century. But even within the bands, it wasn't really hierarchical. It wasn't like, well, the president, and then there's the vice president, the assistant vice president, you know, not like that. So let's just say that you were the young Quanta Parker and you were 18 years old and you wanted to get a raiding party up to go raid the Utes or the Navajos or somebody you were going to raid. Your ability to become a, quote, war chief depended on your ability to recruit. So if you could recruit 50 people to go on a raid, well, you were the war chief. That was your party. And no one was saying, and there was no, you couldn't be overridden by somebody who said, you can't do that. You could recruit it. You could do it. So there was this, again, if you look at from an American sort of management point of view, it's a completely flat organizational structure, which gave it advantages in some ways, and it gave it also some great disadvantages because of a lack of, you know, the kind of militaristic central control that, you know, you would have seen in an army of, say, the Civil War or something.
So yeah, all these things combined, their style of warfare, their fluid political organization. So it made it hard for Anglos to figure out, you know, who's in charge and make treaties or whatever. That allowed the Comanches to fend off the Spanish Empire which again, like conquered the Incans, the Aztecs, these great empires in South America and Mexico. The Comanches were able to hold these guys off for over 100 years, and white people off in general, until the Americans started arriving in Texas around early 1800s, right?
Right. And the term that historians used for what the Comanches were, and again, we're looking at this 250,000 square mile empire that, again, eastern New Mexico, eastern Colorado, western Texas, western Kansas, western Oklahoma, that chunk of land there. It was so powerful that it essentially stopped the, or not essentially, it did stop the expansion of Spanish power into the New World. The Spanish thought that the place was theirs. They ran into first Apaches and then Comanches, but more particularly Comanches. You had Comanches stopping this kind of northward power surge of the Spanish into North America. You had the Comanches stopping this kind of westward surge of French power coming out of the Louisiana Territory. You had them stopping cold, the manifest destiny, you know, the movement westward driven by the idea of manifest destiny of the Americans, of the United States of America. And so you had this kind of phenomenal influencer of history, I guess, because nobody could do anything with this. It was one of the reasons, you know, this was the last part of North America to be settled. Is you had an impenetrable block. And roughly speaking, if you look at the war that the Texans and then later the United States of America fought against the Comanches, this was about a 40-year war, essentially along a single line. I mean, it wasn't, the line would roll west toward Wichita Falls sometimes and backward toward Dallas sometimes, but the United States never fought a war against any tribe that did anything like that. It essentially just stopped everything for a very long time. So, yeah, so that it was the, and the reason that it, in the title, in the subtitle of my book, Empire of the Summer Moon, I say these guys are the most powerful tribe in American history. It's for that reason. They held up everything. They stopped everything, and they stopped it for a long time. Eventually, they lost, but the West wasn't, quote, won, you know, for the white man and his civilization until the Plains Indians lost it.
So this brings us up nicely to where Quanah Parker's story starts, because it starts with a raid on some Texas settlers, I think in like the 1820s, thereabouts, the Parker Raid. Tell us about the Parker Raid and the ramifications of it.
Okay, so this is the great thing about this story is, on the one hand, you have the story of the Comanche tribe, which is a great dramatic story,
right?
Great arc of the rise and fall of the Comanches. You know, they're this little tribe, but a no-count tribe. They get the horse, they become dominant, they sweep south, they change history. That's all big picture stuff. It's great, it's cool. But buried in the middle of that story is the little personal family story about the family, about the Parker family. So what happens is Parker family has gone ahead and built its. They've been given these great head rights from the Mexican government, and one of the reasons the Mexicans are giving out all these head rights to people from the United States is because they want to settle these lands, these borderlands in Texas, and by settling them somehow, kind of solve their Comanche problem. And so there's this raid on the Parker Fort. And this is 1836, raid on the Parker Fort. And they take a bunch of hostages, among them, right, Cynthia Ann Parker. And they ride off into the plains with little old 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, blonde hair, cornflower, blue eyes, you know, the whole deal. They leave. Nothing. It was the most typical raid you could possibly imagine. The Indians did this to each other all the time. This just happened to be, these were white people. Predestinarian Baptists out of, Illinois by way of Virginia. And so this starts this incredible tale. So little Cynthia Ann Parker, she's kidnapped. She's taken away. She becomes part of the tribe. She becomes completely assimilated into the tribe. She marries a war chief. She is, over the years, Indian agents and various people knew where she was, but she wouldn't come in. Which shocked everybody, of course, that the white squaw, as they called her, could possibly, you know, want to spend her life with these horrible savages when she could have her wonderful, you know, European culture that she came from. And so this is the first part of the story. Cynthia Ann goes out and she won't come back. She has children. She marries the war chief. And she has one of her sons is named Quanah. Then by complete accident one day, a bunch of Rangers, Texas Rangers and militia happened to attack a camp where she is located and they recapture her. And this is one of the more amazing moments in the history of the frontier, because you have this, you know, the squaw that would never return. They refused to return to her culture. Well, now they've got her. And they put her up on a box in Fort Worth, and everybody gawks at her and pokes at her up on this box. And when she was captured, she's captured with her daughter, named Prairie Flower, but her sons get away, one of whom is Quanah. And so Cynthia Ann gets dragged back increasingly, you know, farther and farther away from the plains, increasingly into this kind of Anglo-Saxon culture of her family, the Parker family, and she's ever more miserable. Meanwhile, her son, who wasn't captured, Quanah, is out loose on the plains, rising to become the last great chief of the Comanches, and the man who finally surrenders what remains of his tribe after all the buffalo are killed in 1875. And so in a way you have this 40-year war that I talked about between the Comanches and first the Texans and then the people from the United States. And essentially that begins with the kidnapping essentially of Cynthia Ann Parker, and it ends with the surrender of her son, the last and greatest chief of the Comanches, Quanah, in 1875. It's an amazing kind of, they're amazing bookends. Quanah then elects to walk the white man's way, goes on to the reservation, becomes the wealthiest and most influential Native American of the reservation, period, and on and on. And when he finally, and among other things, he attempts to and does locate the grave of his mother. And anyway, the story goes on, but it's one of the great tales of the frontier. And so when you write about it in my book, I get to tell that, you know, that big picture tale of the Comanche tribe, but I also get to tell this, but when you're reading that, you're never very far from the smaller story about this little girl and her son.
No, yeah. When you mentioned that part where they found Cynthia Ann again, and I guess they gave her back to her uncle, and her uncle just put her up on that box, and you said everyone was just gawking, and she started crying.
She was a curiosity. It's hard to imagine the animosity today that people on the frontier felt for, say, Comanches. I mean, everybody knew somebody who'd been killed or tortured, it was very bitter and it was very brutal. And so to have one of them, kind of a live one, you know, right there, but she's white. I mean, it just astounded people.
Yeah. And so you mentioned the Texas Rangers found them. And this is another part of this Comanche story and the story of the Parkers and Quanah. Like, this is also the story of how the Texas Rangers, the mythic Texas Rangers, came to power, came to rise. Like, and what you mentioned this earlier, one reason why the Texas Rangers were so successful at battling Comanches that they learned to fight basically like Comanches.
They imitated everything they did. And that's where the Rangers came from. And one of the things I loved about Lonesome Dove, which you and I both like, is, you know, that the Gus and Captain Call were Rangers of that era. That's who they were. That's why they were good. They fought Comanches and Mexicans, as everybody did in San Antonio. But yeah, I'll tell you a story. This is my favorite story that came out of my book, and I didn't know it before I wrote it. But so let's go to the 1830s, and we're in San Antonio now. It's just right on the edge of the Comanche frontier. And so back in those days, let's take 1836 and forward. 1836 is now, San Antonio is now part of Texas. And what Texas would do, they were very generous with what they called head rights. So they would give you head rights, would mean rights to land. Basically, the land was free. And all you had to do was go out and survey that land, and then it was yours. And so people flocked to San Antonio, and they secured their head rights, which would be, I don't know, call it a few hundred, 600, 800,000 acres, however many acres outside of town. And then the surveyors would go out and survey it. And the surveyors would be killed in all sorts, talk about torture. And the Indians knew exactly what the surveyors were doing. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, the machine that steals the land. No, the machine actually stole the land, and they knew that. The machine stole the land. The surveying equipment did. So they killed them in all sorts of imaginative ways. And so then the people in San Antonio would send out armed guards with the surveyors, and now the death toll rose. In fact, if you see the number of the percentage of dead in 1837, I think this is in my book somewhere, 10 or 15% of the population of San Antonio died every year trying to do this. Comanches didn't like this. One of these surveyors was named Jack Hayes, and he was a skinny little 23-year-old guy who had this ability to keep surveyors alive long enough to, you know, get the headrights and secure the land. And so this group kind of coalesced around him of young guns. They were all 22 years old. And they were all crazy, and they were all very tough. And the Texans had names for them. They called them mounted gunmen and spies. It went there called spies. I don't know why. Eventually, they came up with a name for them that stuck, and it was Rangers. And the other, what the Rangers did was they imitated everything that the Comanches did. They cold camps. Again, you don't build a fire because they can find you. They learned from their various scouts that they used to find the Comanches how to, you know, track bird flight, how to, you know, cross frozen rivers, how to, you know, particularly horse management, which really the white men didn't really understand at all. They didn't understand how you fought on horseback, how you lived with a horse in essentially combat situation. And so this goes on, and Hayes makes a name for himself. He's the man. He's got one problem, though. When his mounted men, who are really good on horseback now, confront Comanches, they've got only three shots. They've got a Kentucky long rifle, bang, that's one, and they've got two single-shot pistols, two, three, and that's it. And you can't reload those on horseback. Can't do it. They were going up against Comanches that had the clusters of arrows in their hands that could shoot very rapidly. They were at a great kind of disadvantage in firepower. And they couldn't do anything about it. They won their battles largely by just being unbelievably aggressive. They would ride forward at full speed screaming, and they would discharge their weapons, and they would often just win by panache, you know, by just guts. And with very much the Captain Call character in McMurtry. Okay, so now something really interesting happens. So go to the East Coast. The East Coast, there's this guy named Samuel Colt, this little inventor guy, and he's invented this weird little weapon. It's a five-shot pistol. I think it's a 36 caliber five-shot pistol. It's got this, but what it's got is it's got a, well, five shots, but it's also got a cylinder that is removable so that you can shoot the five shots, remove the cylinder, and put another cylinder in. And this is a great, he thinks it's a great, you know, cavalry sidearm and everything. Well, at that moment, the United States did not have a cavalry, and nobody wanted this weapon. It was a weapon, it was a clever weapon that had no use, that, as far as anybody could see. Colt goes bankrupt, loses the blueprints, it's over. However, somehow, the Texas Navy bought a crate of those things, of the five shooters, the Patterson Colt five shooters. And somehow it sat in a warehouse in Galveston, and somehow Jack Hayes and his Rangers in San Antonio, which is about, I don't know, maybe 200 miles from there, got a hold of it, got a hold of the crate of guns. He immediately understood what it did. Hayes immediately understood that it would equalize the thing. So now the Hayes Rangers, now they're training with these five shooters, and they're getting really good at them. And in 1844, they take them out and they try them out in Sisterdale, Texas at the Battle of Walker's Creek, and they win. And everything that Hayes thought would happen, you know, happened. And so here, so you had this incredible moment in history. Right then, the Mexican War, and the Mexican War happens. People figure out that there are these crazy rangers in Texas who go everywhere mounted, and they have these repeating pistols. And they now design, Samuel Colt now redesigned something. Now this is called the Walker Colt. It's this 5.5-pound hand cannon that is a six shooter. And it's this, I mean, if you've ever held one, it's a thing to hold. Anyway, it's the six shooter. It changes everything. It kills more men than the Roman short sword. It saves Colt from bankruptcy. Colt gets the military contract to make the six shooters for the Rangers who go into war in Mexico and absolutely light it up. Nobody's ever seen this kind of ability to fight. They're used as sort of anti-guerrilla warriors, and nobody can stand with them. And so It's the invention of the six shooter, and it was invented in order to fight Comanches by people who had adapted warfare against Comanches. And anyway, there's lots of stories like that. That's probably my favorite from the book, just because, you know, it reaches into capitalism in the East Coast and Samuel Colt, who, by the way, becomes the richest man in America because of this, and on and on and on. It's a great story. And you were asking earlier about why people don't know about this. I mean, take somebody like Jack Hayes. I mean, he should be easily as famous as another guy running around San Antonio in those same years named Davy Crockett. And then I don't know why he isn't, frankly.
Yeah. This is going back to Quanah Parker. He kind of rose to power as a war chief as the Comanches were dwindling in power. And that they were dwindling because, okay, the Rangers figured out how to fight them. But the big reason the buffalo were being exterminated, this is when, again, talking about that cross-section of capitalism intersecting with the frontier, this is when the buffalo hunter came to power and they were just wiping out the buffalo. And that was their food source. So I think what led Quanah to finally decide, because I think a lot of these Plains tribes, they fought going on the reservation because they knew as soon as that happened, their way of life would be over. They would no longer be the people or the Comanches.
They were going to have to grow beans and
right,
corn.
Exactly. So they fought it to the end. But why did Quanah, this great war chief who was an adept warrior, why did he decide just to finally surrender and head over to Fort Sill?
Well, to go back to something you said a minute ago, I mean, what killed most of the Indians off was proximity to the white man and white man's diseases. The great percentages of the Indian tribes died, including Comanches, from cholera and white man's diseases. And so you had this wave of starting, I guess, in the 1830s and 40s and 50s. I mean, it was just, I mean, half an entire tribe would be taken out, or two-thirds of an entire tribe. And the problem was that the closer you were to the white man's frontier, the more there was interaction with white men and trade and so forth, and the more the diseases spread. Quanah Parker happened to be part of a band that lived way out in West Texas, if you've ever been to Amarillo, out there in the panhandle. And they were, his band, the Quahatis, were remote, I guess. They were the most remote band from whatever white frontier you were looking at. One of the reasons they were able to avoid disease is that they did not themselves go and interact. They didn't, when they wanted to trade with Santa Fe, with the Spanish and the Mexicans in Santa Fe, they would trade through the intermediaries, these intermediaries called Comancheros. And so basically they, out on the plains there, they were disease-free and therefore their numbers stayed up. This was Quanah's people. And so what happened it's kind of a cascading effect. The Civil War came and both North and South governments turned their attentions elsewhere and allowed the frontier to kind of fester. But after the war was over, you know, the people in charge in Washington pretty soon decided that they were going to put a stop to this. And in the 1870s, you have the first of these big expeditions being sent out. We're now going to end this. We're going to end this nonsense. How could this tribe with 5,000 people in it or whatever, 5,000 warriors, be holding up the entire advance of, you know, Western civilization, which is the way it was seen? And so you have this, not only is it a moment when you have military forces now being unleashed against Quanah and his band and his out in the panhandle, out in West Texas. But you also have the phenomenon you were talking about, which is the deliberate tolerance by Washington, by the military establishment in particular, of the wholesale killing of all the buffalo in the plains. And for a plains Indian, the buffalo was everything. The buffalo was the food. The buffalo were the clothing, the lodging, the weapons, the food. It was an entire way of life. Everything came from the buffalo. Without the buffalo, a Plains Indian wasn't really a Plains Indian. And so you have a couple of things going on. You have the military now, you know, Quanah and his guys have Ulysses S. Grant, William Tecumseh Sherman, and Philip Sheridan full attention. And these are some serious warriors who beat the South in the Civil War. And they have their full attention. You have a military campaign being run against them. You have all of their buffalo being slaughtered. And at the end of this kind of last great gasp of all this, the Red River War, it's pretty much all over for the Plains Indians. Now, Quanah himself was never captured. He never lost a battle to the white men. He was out there. He stayed out. He could have stayed out really possibly as long as he wanted to, but at some point he realized that primarily all of the food source was dead. He realized that all the buffalo were dead. He realized that the lifestyle was going to have to change. So in 1875, he and the last of kind of the starving Comanches, who are now eating prairie dogs if they can get them, they come in. There really is no choice. They don't want to go farm beans and corns, and they never did. And when they were given land to do so, they sublet it to white farmers. They never would do it anyway. They were never going to be anything but who they were, which was hunters of bison or buffalo on the plains. So Quanah essentially was the last gasp of that. He was the last holdout, one of the last holdouts, the last Comanche holdout. And when he came in, he acknowledged that if they were going to come into a reservation somewhere, they were going to have to change their ways.
And he did. I mean, I think a lot of Native Americans who went to the reservation, sort of this stereotype of them becoming very sullen and, you know, sort of not working and just living off the things they get from the government. But Quanah, he became incredibly industrious, he adapted to the white man's way to the point where he, as you said earlier, gained an incredible amount of power, a great amount of wealth, and he also became a celebrity during the late 19th century, early 20th century.
He did. He did this amazing transformation from being one of the most feared warriors of his era. And he did things, he never talked about what he did, but of course, because he was a Comanche, we sort of know what he did. And it was brutal, and he was a young man, but he was a true Comanche Plains warrior. And when he had his vision and he went in, he decided he was going to walk the white man's walk. And he did. And one of the interesting things he realized that cattle and land was the name of the game. And he played it just as well as anyone ever did, certainly as well as any white man did. I mean, he outfoxed the white man at his little cattle leasing schemes. He was absolutely magnificent testifying for the Jerome Commission in Washington about Comanche land allotments. He was a true leader of his tribe, and he was the leader of his tribe from the time that he surrendered in 1875 till his death in 1911. But yeah, he became wealthy, built this giant house out on the plains, he tried to get the U.S. government to build it for him, of course, but they wouldn't. He got his cattlemen friends to build it for him, this magnificent place called Star House out on the plains. That if you had walked into Star House in, say, 1890, you just wouldn't have believed what you were looking at. He had six wives in the house. He had 20 or 21 children, 19 of whom survived to adulthood. He had children who were, sorry, the children married white people. He had an adopted white son living with him. He had like a Russian-Mexican cook in there. He would have, you know, Geronimo and you and army generals like Nelson Crook to dinner in the house. Around the house at any given moment, there you would see lodges, teepees, as many as 80 or 90 of them, Comanche tribe members who would come in to get a loan or a gift or money or to be healed, because Quanah founded the Native American church with its peyote ritual, you know, to get buried. I mean, this reservation world revolved around him. And as you said earlier, it would not be accurate to say that most Comanches were willing to follow him and to follow his path. They simply didn't want it to be what the American military establishment and political establishment wanted them to be, which was bean farmers. They never wanted to do that, and they never did that.
And speaking of other people you might see at his Star House, Teddy Roosevelt, President Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, Teddy Roosevelt. He made a visit down to Quanah.
He was there once, and it's this great, it's still sitting up there. It's falling down now. It's a true shame that Star House has gone to seed up there in Cache, Oklahoma. But one of the great thrills for me of writing the book was going up there and discovering it. You know, sitting in the room where that famous picture of Cynthia Ann sat on Quanah's wall, and into the dining room where Geronimo had dinner with him and so forth.
So Sam, as you said, this story, it's a big story, an epic story of the American West, the closing of the frontier, but it's also had these small stories of families, of individuals. I mean, after someone reads this book, what do you hope they walk away with after finishing it?
I think what I didn't really, when I was writing it, I didn't have a, I didn't have an agenda. I wasn't trying to do anything in particular except to present a balanced view of the frontier. But it was interesting because I was, I wrote the book and I started to get these questions that were, do you know who Don Imus is?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm being interviewed by Imus and I'm in some studio in Dallas and Imus loved the book. And when it came out, he jumped on and I'm interviewing him. I'm in some studio in Dallas wearing headphones and he goes up. He goes, Sam, when you wrote this book, did you have to stop and take a couple deep breaths before you wrote a complete revisionist history of Native Americans? And then I go, what are you talking about? I honestly didn't know what he meant. Okay, 1,000 similar questions later, I now know what he was talking about. And what he was talking about was that you had all these kind of myths and counter myths that were flying around in this country anyway in the 20th century. You had this kind of idea that early on that the army, and you can see this in Hollywood totally, it's the army is all good, it's the cavalry coming in, it's the horrible, mean Indians, right? And that was that idea that Indians are bad. And then you had a complete kind of snapback from that, and the poster book for which was Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which is that the Indians are, they're noble, gentle people that we just steamrolled over and broke all our treaties and took their lands and destroyed them, all of which is true, by the way. But there was that particular side, and the Bury My Heart side of the myth, or the Bury My Heart myth, had kind of neglected this idea that Indians were powerful in their own right, cruel in their own right, powerful, cruel, that the Comanches were nobody's fool and certainly didn't get rolled over by anybody. They put up a 40-year fight. They drove the Spanish out of the New World and they put up a 40-year fight against the Texans and the Americans. But it was that sense, I guess, and I approached it just as I'm a reporter. I mean, I was a magazine writer and a newspaper writer. I just try to, you try to interview both sides, you come to conclusions, but you try to be balanced in your coverage. And that's all I was. I was trying to be balanced. So if I talk about Comanches torturing babies, and I also talk about what the Rangers did to Indians, which was just as horrifying. Not because I was trying to make an ideological point with it, but because it was true. But because the borderlands, the frontier were an extremely violent and brutal place, and the violence came from both sides. And you had a culture of kind of vengeance that comes out of it. And if you've ever seen the movie The Searchers, and the character of John Wayne is just so brilliant. It's this guy who embodies the bitterness of the frontier and what it's like to have to lose people. Both sides had that. And so I guess what I would like readers to feel, if anything, and this is related to what I was just saying, is that as a reporter, I was balanced. I was sympathetic to both sides because, were the Comanches noble? Yes, they were. They had a fantastic culture. They're family oriented. I mean, they were also, you can go on about that. And they were also warriors of a very high order who were exceptionally cruel when it came to hostages and captives. I guess that's what I would want people to know, is that it wasn't, both myths are incomplete, I guess.
No, yeah, that's what I took away. It reiterated the point that human beings, all human beings, are complex, messy creatures. As I read this, I was horrified by both what the Rangers and the Comanches did, but also inspired by both. I was sad, what happened with the Comanches at the end, just seeing that, it was a people that ended, basically. Yeah, that story you told at the end where Quanah goes on one last buffalo hunt.
Oh, isn't that sad?
And there's nothing there. And that's, I think they realized it's over. And I was just like, that's just devastating. So yeah, it's a really great book. Sam Gwynn, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you too, Brett. So maybe we'll talk again about the Civil War someday or something.
No, yeah, you got that book Rebel Yell about Stonewall Jackson, and it's on my to read list. So we're going to make that happen.
All right.
My guest today was Sam Gwynn. He's the author of the book Empire of the Summer Moon. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can find out more information about Sam's work at scgwynn.com or check out our show notes at aom.is/Comanches, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic.
Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you find our podcast archives. There's over 500 episodes there. And we've got thousands of articles we've written over the years about basically everything: personal finance, physical fitness, how to be a better husband, better father. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness to get 1 month free of Stitcher Premium. Once you've signed up, download the Stitcher app on iOS or Android, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the Art of Manliness podcast. Again, stitcherpremium.com, promo code manliness. And if you enjoy the show and you've got something out of it, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. Helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member you think will get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only to listen to the AWIN podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.